It's the little things. I'm recording for patrons, by the way.
What's the, how do I sound?
It's to do. Ooh.
How do I sound?
You're very low.
Yeah.
Thanks, Reinhold. Thanks for helping, Reinhold.
Well, I didn't know if you could hear me or not.
Yeah, we sound great.
I was hoping.
All right, sorry. I had to switch whole computers. I'm on the Mac. I believe it's called High Sierra. I hate it.
This one doesn't look like it's stuttering as much as last time.
Yeah, it's really clear.
Yeah, yeah. I'm thinking my power supply must have been going out thin, and it finally went.
Well, you're really low, and Reinhold's a tad high.
Oh, a tad high.
Yeah, because he's so low, it makes you sound high.
I'm using an iPad. I was redocking.
How does that sound now?
This is the problem. Okay. There's too many Apple products right now. There's too many Apple products in my room, and that's the problem. There's too.
It's good, Reinhold. Can you turn yourself up, please?
How do I do that on Apple?
More than zero is too many.
What are you using? A board?
I'm going through the Scarlett.
It should be on your Scarlett then. It'll be your gain on your Scarlett. I've been on an ELO kick. It's just so positive.
Oh, ELO is such a...
All right, how's this?
I grew up with that.
Much better.
That's my jam.
It's like magic.
Mr. Blue Sky just makes me feel good every time I hear it. Just
a lot of it, because most of the Scarlet is controlled through my Windows box, which now has a bad power supply.
Oh.
Apparently, yeah.
Can you turn it up more?
Yeah, I just kind of... I was kind of scared of the nozzle because, like, on this thing, it looked like it jumped up there. I was like, oh, crap. Scared of the nozzle. How's this? Is this better?
Yes. Perfect.
All right.
Yep. I like
it. Oh, man. How about here where I'm going to be sitting at? Oh, my God. What is this happy crap?
Sun is shining in the sky.
No.
Hey.
Running Valley Avenue. See how the sun shines brightly in the city.
Then you have Don't Bring Me Down.
2, 3, 4.
How can you be mad with this?
You got me running, going out of my mind.
So good.
Bring me down.
And then Sweet Talking Woman. Great song. Better than Evil Woman.
The Telephone Line is a great song. But it's one that used that.
I've been searching for a one-way street. I was stepping
up. Here's Telephone Line.
Is this what a road trip like with Chris Spangle is?
No, that's all.
Remember
all audiobooks about death and liberty.
There was a Sunday night show that used to be on Q95 back in the 80s. I don't know if you remember it or not. But it was basically just a guy who did a talk show for like two or three hours. And he talked about the weirdest things you can think of, you know, the House of Blue Lights, the silos, all the different little weird stories in the United States that were going on in the city. And he started off with that theme, the telephone line theme,
yeah,
because people would call in. It was so good.
Harry's lighting a candle. All right, I gotta start this because by 7:24 we'll lose our ID. So let me hit go live.
Higher and higher, it's the little things.
You're listening to the We Are Libertarians Network. Find more great shows like this at WeAreLibertarians.com.
All right, let's get back to some boring subjects.
Understand the risk to our country.
Freedom brings people together.
You're listening to the We Are Libertarians Network. Learn more at WeAreLibertarians.com.
Welcome to the program. My name is Chris Spangle. It's great to be with you. Reinhold and Harry are here tonight. And we are going to be discussing Joe Biden's record, specifically his crime and his drug record, which are the most troubling and probably most telling. So, all of which he says wasn't as bad as it was. So, stay tuned and we'll find out more about that after this.
Warning. This show is for adults, produced by semi-adults. So the language is sometimes strong and offensive.
I don't know what I said.
Welcome to We Are Libertarians, where our goal is to help you sound smarter while talking to your friends. We examine current events from a libertarian perspective while treating modern politics with all of the irreverence it deserves.
There has been lie after lie.
We toss out the screaming heads, put people before political parties, and give context to the news to make you think. Now, here's our host, a 15-year veteran of politics and media, Chris Spangle.
Welcome to the program. It is so great to be with you. I want to thank everybody for listening. Thanks to our patrons. We'll thank you specifically in just a moment. Thanks to Harry and Reinhold for being here. Harry, how are you tonight?
Going terrible.
Really? Don't jinx us. You always say you're going good, going good. And then this is the first terrible?
Yeah. My power supply died after 10 long years of being cooped up inside my case. It's dead, and I regret to inform everyone that I am now broadcasting on a Mac Pro tower and looking at my show notes on an iPad.
Wow. I finally won the war after a long 5-year battle over your inferior Windows products and you trashing Macs for 5 long years. Vanquished. Would you like to make a public apology?
I'd like to apologize to the Apple people. For some reason, if you just leave your Apple stuff in the corner, don't touch it, it just turns on, ready to go, just like an old friend, just ready to go.
Yep. Reinhold, who is a Microsoft fanboy, which you don't find many of them. That shows you how old he is. This must be a tough day for you now that you've lost one.
It's not so much a fanboy. It's that's how I make my living.
Right.
And trust me, when people want to get work done, they use Windows. So.
Well, I seem to get a lot of work done on this Mac.
We're talking about Biden's record tonight. Is this the one that was on the top 40 charts?
Yes, right, yeah. Help, please let me plagiarize you. That's, I think, what it was called. See, you know, Reinhold's camera just disappeared. I have no problems on my Mac Pro. That's all I'm saying on this iMac Pro that I've this beautiful machine. It's so powerful, so beautiful. So works.
Yeah, mine is not the Windows machine. It's the power connection to the camera appears to be funky right now. Yeah, I gotta figure out.
Yeah, we all three look better. We, you know, I clipped the heck out of the TK Coleman episode because it was so good. And we all three look terrible. He looks fantastic. He sounds fantastic. He's just better than us.
She should have had full screen of him the whole time.
Just the whole time, because every time I was editing the video and went to the three of us freaks, I'm like, ugh, go back to TK. The great appearance, really. He said this is the first libertarian podcast that he thought he had done, and so we were honored to have him. So if you didn't listen to 448, you definitely should, because it was just tremendous. We are just a few show notes right up here at the top. We are launching a new program. So as we head into the election year, So here's what you have to understand about a presidential election year. Every 4 years, it's like libertarian podcasting Black Friday. You know, all the stores make all their money on Black Friday, and we are no exception. And so from Labor Day to Christmas in a presidential year, it's astronomical growth for podcasts. We've had on a couple episodes 3 times our normal download numbers. And that stuff usually holds. And so, A, we want to thank everybody who is listening for the first time, all the new people, everybody that is choosing to dip their toe in the water and figure out what a libertarian is. I know it can seem very confusing. And I had a friend, her name is Julia, who will be helping on the project that you'll hear forthcoming, message me, and she's like, I want to recommend to my friends something. Do you have anything? And even our stuff on our website, frankly, was not very good and very outdated because in 2013, I served as the marketing director for the Advocates for Self-Government, which if you've ever taken the world's smallest political quiz, that diamond that where you find out that you're a libertarian because it's sneakily crafted, I was their marketing director and put a lot of stuff together, and that's kind of lived on the wall website, and it's a little disjointed, and we talk about issues, and we talk about it for 2 hours, and we, you know, it's not that we're a bad entry point. It's just it may not be the right fit, and there are several 101 resources out there to explain libertarianism, but I just didn't. There some of them are very professorial, some of them are very aggressive, and so we're working on a special project called Liberty Explained, and it's up at Liberty. So here is the website, just so you can take a look at what we're putting together. LibertyExplained.com, and we already have, you know, I've organized and cleaned up all the various resources that we've put together over the years, you know, the quizzes so you can kind of see what type of libertarian you are, the video playlists, you know, the basics of libertarianism, libertarian philosophy, views on the issues, reading lists, basics of libertarianism. We're going to restart our book recommendations. Libertarianpodcast.com has been completely updated, and you can see that here. So we've got all the libertarian podcasts, both big and small, you know, from every angle, all on there, so you can choose to help grow the libertarian podcast space with that website. List of libertarian websites, got all those cleaned up as well, and took Chris Cantwell's website. That's how old some of this stuff was. Reinhold Cantwell was on there from 2013. And then we've also been updating our training podcast, and there's a Google Doc, a Google Drive of a ton of training manuals, like how to run for office, how to talk to the media, just all kinds of stuff for you. So we've got all this stuff kind of covered from every angle, you know, book recommendations, website recommendations, and there's an Instagram too for Liberty Explained. And so this is the homepage at libertyexplained.com. And what we're going to do is do 10 to 15 minute podcasts around a singular issue. We had about 100 respondents to a survey that we recently put out. We had excellent questions, and we are working on answering those questions as quickly as possible, doing the libertarian solutions to these issues one issue at a time. So you can grab that video or podcast or meme or blog post and share that with your friends. So it's going to be super slick, super easy. We're really excited about it. We've got about, we did an hour and a half conference call last night to start the work on it. Over the next 2 or 3 weeks, we're going to be doing a lot of the writing and recording. And then hopefully within the month, we're going to have that rolled out and start publishing episodes. You can already subscribe to the podcast. So you can go in any podcast catcher. Just type in We Are Libertarians and subscribe to all of our shows like Freedom Strips and On the Run with Remzo Martinez and Boss Hogg and The Brian Nichols Show and Gingerarchy and Upward and all the shows. But add Liberty Explained to your podcatcher, because soon we will be giving out those 10-15 minute bites, putting it out on all of our platforms to help you. If you're not sure what the heck this libertarian stuff is all about, you can send in a question, wearelibertarians.com/contact, and ask us a question. We'll probably answer it through the course of doing this show. And then also, we want to give you a great resource to share with your friends and family as they're asking questions, trying to be nonpartisan, as fair as possible. What I told everybody is we're representing the broad spectrum of libertarian thought on an issue. We're not representing our personal opinions on stuff. And that includes movement stuff. So we're going to talk about not just libertarian solutions to issues, but also the broader philosophy, the history, and what happens in the libertarian movement. So we want it to be a website that is a complete guide to understanding libertarianism and the libertarian movement. So please go check that out and tell your friends about it. So there's some stuff there if you already want to dip your toe in the water. Now, all of this, you know, the time that it takes to put something like that together, it took me a long weekend building the website and cleaning two long weekends to clean all that stuff up and get everything ready. But, you know, it costs money to buy templates and images and graphics and domains and hosting, and all that stuff is all provided for by our patrons. And if you are not a patron, then we encourage you to go to WeAreLibertarians.com and look for the support button, grab it there, or go to Patreon.com/WeAreLibertarians. And that is how we fund this. We don't have ads currently. I have resisted doing ads for the longest time because I just, ugh. And, you know, it changes the content somewhat. And, you know, you get ticked off sponsors. I've been, you know, anyways, I won't go into it. It's advertisers. So you say one wrong thing on Facebook and then they're mad. That's just how it works. So Anthony Meyer, I want to thank our $100 a month Patreon subscribers: Anthony Meyer, Brad Tracy, Craig DaCosta, Ed Brehab, Jason Doolittle, Jeff Bennett, Christy Avery, Matthew Durbin, and Ryan Hold. Thank you all so much for being $100 a month subscribers. You guys are the real MVP. That's right. Yeah. Not HPV. So we got this great letter that I wanted to read from you to you, somebody who is newer to the show and wrote in to tell us why she loves the show. Her name is Jessica. Hey, Chris, I've been a listener for almost 2 years now, and after the past two episodes, I wanted to write you and let you know how much I appreciate your show. I've been a libertarian for almost 20 years. Yes, there are some of us who aren't crazy and longtime libertarians, but I find I don't fit into a lot of the libertarian cliques. In fact, I frequently don't agree with you or a number of your co-hosts. However, that's a good thing. Your show gives me some perspectives I can't find anywhere else. It makes me think about different sides and perspectives on issues. Frequently, I will agree in part, but disagree in part. Your show is presented in a respectful and thoughtful manner that doesn't make me rage quit. You never say, if you don't agree with me, then you're stupid, or you're a Nazi, or you're a leftist. I added the last part, the last two parts. So many other political podcasts do that, and nothing will make me quit listening faster than that. You also don't twist the issue to make it fit your perspective or to convince people to agree with you. Lastly, your show is well-researched, and you show your sources. That makes your arguments all the more credible and persuasive. Thank you for all your hard work. P.S. Can we get more Abdul? He's awesome. It's been a while since I've heard him on your show. I will be sure to tell him you know, Abdul lost both of his parents over the last couple months, and our heart goes out to him. He is my mentor, my friend, and just a tremendous guy, and love when he comes on to stir the S. He is anti-Black Lives Matter, and as a black man, nothing drives the local BLM people crazier. We actually had him on talking about race issues a while ago, so if you just look up ABDUL in the feed, you'll hear that. And why that drives people so crazy. So thank you for all those show announcements. I really do appreciate your patience in talking about some of that stuff because it is important, both LibertyExplained.com and the new Patreon. So with that being said, what we want to do tonight is talk about Joe Biden. So, and then next week we will talk about Donald Trump's record. Now, here's the thing when we're talking about these two candidates. We end up talking a lot about the context of the race and less about the policy. You know, Donald Trump is running almost a policy-less campaign at this point. Joe Biden has a ton of policy proposals, but nobody's talking about that. Everybody's talking about, you know, sort of the context of the moment that we're in as opposed to where they've been, what they're going to do. Today, we're going to focus more on Joe Biden's record. We will at some point do an episode talking about what Joe Biden is proposing to do as president. Time precludes that today. And, you know, it's looking more and more, Reinhold, like he may be the next president of the United States. Some of this polling that is starting to come in is absolutely brutal.
It is, and it kind of has been for a while, and people were just like, oh, that's just the lead up. We don't have a definitive candidate yet. We've got all these things going on that the polling just hasn't settled. But really, when you start seeing numbers going the opposite direction of what you need to be at this point in the game, it just becomes harder just to get back to the point where you need to be, where you're even, right? Not necessarily win. So I don't see, in my personal view, I don't see a path to victory for Trump, but I'm not saying that it can't happen. This is 2020. We have still a long way to go. Who knows, right?
It's
currently kind of looking that way.
Yeah, and it's not like 2016 where it was, you know, I think you could say that it was a 2016 race probably in January because the economy was really strong. And you know, he tweeted out something today about players kneeling. And I just thought, you know, that was really like groundbreaking shitposting in 2018. But now that everybody's unemployed and sick and like we're in the middle of a pandemic and a Great Depression is looming and like it just doesn't have the same weight, all your nonsense anymore. You know, and things have just changed so drastically. We're in one of the more traumatic years in like as a society, like, you know, my year's gone okay, but but I know that most of our listeners probably it has not. And as a society, I can't think of a more tumultuous year in my lifetime, and that includes 2002, 2001, 2002. Like, this is...
It reminds me much more of 68.
Yeah.
Which a lot of people probably, you know, I barely remember anything that far back. I'm not quite that old, but... It was just like considered a watershed year with all of the social upheaval and everything that was going on from the end of the civil rights kind of upheaval to Vietnam to, you know, people getting arrested and beaten down by police at the Democratic National Convention, just all of that stuff tying hand in hand and creating an environment that seems like the only thing familiar to that to me.
Yeah. Harry, I mean, where's your gut at on the race? Do you even care?
One, you're right. I do not care. a tyrant is a tyrant is a tyrant. The other thing is, I hate it when people count Trump out, because usually when you count him out in down, that's when he wins. And
right.
That scares the crap out of me more than anything. What? You can't sit here and tell me that that's how it was in 2016. Oh, man,
no.
This is the moment. He's down now. He's just, and this is the same thing. It's like the exact same moment. You're like, well, he's crap posting on these kneeligans, even though the NBA's freaking ratings are freaking dropping. They're dropping.
Yeah.
And the one guy, and the one man in the NBA who decided to stand up, his jersey sales are selling. And there's no boycott going on for that. So
stand up by saying, I'm not going to, you know,
kneel for the national anthem. Yeah.
Okay.
Yep.
Yeah. If you go woke, you go broke. That's the old saying in media. Here's the difference in that. And as we'll kind of see as we go through the stuff, you know, Hillary Clinton is a despicable person that is despised by almost everyone. Joe Biden is seemingly normal and has a reputation of being a normal person. There's a... You know, Greg Lenz wrote an op-ed on WeAreLibertarians.com on the last day of the Obama administration about Joe Biden, talking about what a great guy he was, you know, and I imagine, you know, who knows what that looks like now. But Joe Biden is the type of person that, like, you know, regular Joe riding the Amtrak to work every day. And I'm a blue collar guy. He's had all these big emotional moments in front of people with the loss of his wife and the loss of his daughter and then the loss of his son. He evokes out of even opponents. He has tended to view politics as like, yeah, we just disagree. We don't need to be enemies. Whereas Hillary Clinton is, you know, like a House of Cards type figure that people despise. And I think in 2016, people felt, you know, we know her. We know we don't like her. We've tried to get rid of her. She won't stop coming back. This guy's kind of fun and funny. We might get some tax cuts out of the deal. He could be a centrist. We don't know what this is. Let's give it a shot. Let's roll the dice. And I think, I mean, obviously that backfired. I mean, the pandemic and everything, the response to it, when you look at when you look at America versus other countries and how they handled it, this, you know, we took a lot of shit from libertarians early on because we believed the virus was real, and we still continue to do, you know, voluntarily sheltering in place to get the R-naught value below zero means a lot less spread. And the second they introduced government to prohibit movement and tell people what to do and then force them to wear masks, all of a sudden everybody's doing the opposite, and everybody is, you know, prohibition always backfires every time it's tried. And, you know, that's led to what we always said is that the virus is going to cause an economic shutdown, and it's going to cause bankruptcies, and it's going to cause a lot of misery if it runs out of control. Well, we're about to find that lesson out hard, unfortunately, as a nation, because Donald Trump and the CDC took control of testing. They completely messed it up. They told people not to wear masks at the very moment they should have been wearing masks. And people, you know, the people who just blindly believe everything the government says said, oh, I'm not going to wear a mask. Now wear a mask. And everything is just completely hypocritical from, you know, the feds on down. I mean, they've mismanaged the responsibilities that the federal government had. They mismanaged at every point and made this worse. And that led to governors and local authorities doing the same. And so people just kind of shrugged their shoulders, moved on, and here we are. So that is leading to a situation where you could have a significant long-term, you know, with the virus, which I don't care what you say, like the math is there, the death rate is, you know, somewhere over 3, you know, and it is not as deadly to somebody like me, but it is not the flu. It's very clearly worse than the flu. But this is going to lead to long-term economic complications because at the very beginning, they took 6 weeks to just chill and ignore it, and maybe it'll go away. And he's still doing that. He said in the interview with Axios, there is such a thing as too much testing. No, there's not. Like, not at all, not even a little bit is that even remotely true. So his response to this, and then his response to the Black Lives Matter stuff and the George Floyd death, like, he's a known quantity now, and he's sort of fulfilling what Hillary Clinton's campaign fundamentally was about. Who do you want answering that 4 a.m. phone call? And we're about to see which geriatric, like, I'm sorry, there's definitely cognitive decline in both of these men. I'm not meaning that to be pejorative. Like, you know, they're both missing a step, you know, and these are our choices from the Republicans and the Democrats, you know. And I think people are going to look at it and go, I'd rather have the Democrat who isn't just living outside of reality, pretending. Like, you watch these interviews. Did you either of you watch the Wallace interview or the Axios interview that aired over the weekend?
I saw some of the Axios and some text from the Wallace one, but I haven't seen the Wallace. I saw the clips from the Axios one, though. So.
It's
generated a great meme template that I'm going to be using.
It's truly mystifying. Like, it's he's Donald Trump is out to lunch. Like, he, and that's what I don't get. Like, Joe Biden clearly is missing a step too, but like, that's going to be your argument is he's more addled than I am.
What? And the thing about Trump too is I keep hearing this thing about, well, this is what Trump always does. And when you say always does, you mean one time.
Right.
He won one election, and now everybody thinks he's a political genius because he ran an election year that was the most terrible as far as the two most hated people, right? People didn't want Bush, Clinton.
Right.
That's what that was about. They did not want Clinton in there again.
They thought, what damage can he really do? Let's elect the guy.
He's got all these people protecting him. He's got the government and this, and he's talking about how he's going to destroy the swamp. He's made the swamp deeper and thicker and uglier than anything. It's not it's not clean. He's not fixed the swamp. He's just made it worse.
So
all the things he's ran on, he's failed at. I mean.
So that's why I kind of look at it and go, it's not 2016 and there's not some big silent majority that he keeps, you know, trying to manifest into reality that there's just some big base. So, I mean, do you understand, like, do you see that point of view, Harry, or are you still kind of...
I see that point of view, but that's not the info I'm seeing. I do not see this groundswell, especially in the black community, for Biden. Mm. I have seen so many black people just said, I'm going to vote D down ballot and libertarian for the presidential. Mm. And that is what I'm seeing. Right. That is what I'm hearing. And I'm hearing this from, like, hardcore Ds. Just like, nope, that's what I'm doing. I'm going to go D down ballot, libertarian for the presidential, and walking out of there. And I was like, ouch.
I'm seeing no enthusiasm from the pat down audience. You know, my Instagram specifically, there's mm-hmm. not much love. And you'll hear why. Like, all the stuff that the black community talks about and why they distrust the government, Joe Biden was the architect of. Right. So it makes total sense. And then he's going to pick Kamala Harris, which shows he's not serious about having changed any of these ways.
Yeah. But then you've got Trump, who Biden makes the gaffes and talks about, you know, if you don't vote for me, you're not black. And then the next, like, 2 days later, Trump is doing something outrageous that's even worse than that, as far as, you know, the Wallace protests and everything else. He said in that interview with Wallace, what he says is, nobody's done it more for black people than I have. And he said that repeatedly over the past year.
Right.
And I don't know where he's getting that from. That's the
he's
funniest
making
thing,
it right? up.
I mean, it's just his own cognitive dissonance in that. He believes it. That's the thing. He believes that.
He really, he's the last month and in these interviews, like, it really has been, like, I'm watching that Axios and, like, my jaw's just kind of hang. Like, so with Trump, like, I always found Trump to be funny. And, like, there was an, like, Trump was always grounded in reality. He was, like, petty. You know, mm-hmm. a petty person is kind of like, this is unfair and these people are annoying, so I'm going to poke them and they'll poke me back and then I'll poke them. Like, he really has kind of become a little bit, like, I think he can tell he's going to lose big and he's trying to do everything in his power to fix it. And the way that he knows how to fix things is through brute force and gaslighting. And, like, this Axios interview from the weekend or the Chris Wallace interview are just you have to go watch them in anticipation. But anyways, we're talking about all the, you know.
One more thing real quick before we jump on to Biden. The, you know, he made his 2016 run basically calling out the establishment, the incumbency, the politicians as they're running things, the people in power. Mm-hmm. He can't run on that again because he's the one who's been in power for 4 years. He's completely neutered himself from that line of politicking. I mean, to the fact that he's running ads now saying, is this what you want? This is the America Joe Biden wants. And he's showing pictures from the Wallace or, you know, from the BLM protests and the, you know, the burning of some buildings and things like that. He's showing what his administration has done and trying to say that this is what you'll get with Biden. It's like, how he can't figure out how to run on defending his record as opposed to attacking another person's record.
Because he's a white grievance politician. He's a victim. He is a reactionary. And reactionaries don't do well once they actually have to lead. Like, once you actually are responsible for something, you're in charge of something, and you can't blame other people, you can only take responsibility. He's just not built for that, which is why a loss for him is what he really wants, because then he can go back to making more money as a grievance politician. But although his businesses, because of the pandemic, you know, somebody, I think it was David Frum, was talking about, you know, what happens to Trump when nobody's going to hotels, specifically his hotels, nobody's traveling to his resorts, and he doesn't have the federal government to keep the bottom line afloat, because that's what he's doing right now, is he's housing everybody and, you know, using the federal government to pad his bottom line. For instance, Mike Pence, when he traveled to Scotland, instead of staying near the summit location, he stayed 180 miles away at a Trump resort. You know, it's stuff like that where that's how he's kind of padding stuff. Okay, so let's go on to the – did I cut you off, Harry? I'm sorry. I was looking down.
I'm just saying, who wouldn't want to stay in a Trump resort? But all I'm saying is the worst thing you can do for Trump is to count him out like that. I'm just – all I'm saying is – his base is his base, and they're locked in.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Biden has no base.
He doesn't. Biden has the base of we hate Trump.
Yeah,
he's got right he's now got, the we hate Trump base is greater than the we love Trump base.
Eh. I don't think so.
Look at the numbers. We're talking Trump's top number is like 35 to 40%. That's it.
Yeah,
but it was during the campaign.
There are so many Bernie bros that are out there that are just saying no. Every little super.
Yeah, but they're not going to vote for Trump, though. That's what I'm saying.
Are they
going to
vote?
Go and vote for Trump. They'll either not vote, or they'll vote for the Green Party candidate, or they'll vote for Jorgensen.
Yeah.
Which doesn't matter. I mean, if he's not getting the votes, the people who are in it for the political calculus of we need to vote him out, we're not going to let what happened in 2016 happen again. Look at the record numbers of people going to the primaries this year on the Democratic side. There were huge numbers showing up and voting in the Democratic primary, right?
Yep.
That's new. I mean, that's large numbers. These people are deciding they're not going to take the chance to stay home again and have what happened in 2016. A lot of people in 2016 thought that Hillary had it in the bag and they stayed home and didn't vote.
That's one argument, but the other argument is people may not go vote. There may not be polling places open. There may be too many factors. You know, the best hope for Trump. So here's why I say it looks like a historic loss. Like when you look at the Senate races, the only Senate, so the Republicans had to defend 23 Senate seats, and the only one that is a toss up is, or the only one that looks like they'll take is Doug Jones in Alabama. All the rest of them, and I'm talking Cornyn in Texas, we're talking deep red states like Montana, you know, they're losing Senate seats in these red states, and all of his polling has Biden up 5 to 10 points in places like North Carolina, Florida, Ohio's now in play, Michigan is basically done, the Trump campaign pulled out of that, Wisconsin is done. Arizona, Colorado, Nevada, Texas is looking like it may flip blue this time, you know. And so the polling wasn't wildly wrong in 2016. It was just wrong, and they didn't account for certain things. And they didn't see those 77,000 votes in some of those blue states that everybody was ignoring. So there's a lot more attention being paid to how polling is done. But the polling is still difficult because of cell phones, and it's hard to reach people. It's not the way that it used to be. Email polling is not as reliable. And then there's also just the factor of how will Election Day go? What I will say is that you're in charge of your vote, and this is a situation where we tend to think those people are in charge of making sure I get to vote right. No, you need to be calling your county clerk, and you need to be following up with your clerk to figure out how you can vote. You need to help your family do that. Because here's the reason why. Election night is not going to be like the election night those of us who are 36 like myself and been following campaigns since 92 have always been like, where, you know, by 9 p.m. on 2016, we knew Donald Trump was president, essentially, right? This may not be that. This is going to be a lot of mail-in voting. A lot of absentee voting. Just kidding. It's the same thing. There's going to be, it could be, you know, Pennsylvania specifically could take weeks after the election to report, and that's a swing state. And so if it is not a blowout for one side or the other, it's going to be weeks like 2000 of, it's going to be worse than 2000, because while a lot of the 2000 election was because Republican operatives stormed the election center and started finagling things and trying to push the envelope in certain places, they did have some measure of dignity compared to Donald Trump and the way that he handles things. You know, I just don't think that's in dispute between Bush versus Trump and their understanding and respect for the system. And so you could have the president sitting there tweeting. There's some thought that like Trump may just go to Mar-a-Lago if he loses and then just stop doing the job, just no show, no call, no show as president for like a few months. And nobody would know what would happen. Like, what if the guy just stops answering the phone because he's so mad that he lost? Just firing out tweets, but he's not doing the job as president, which he's barely doing already. So
that was different than what he's doing now.
Yeah, but, you know, at least he's in the Oval Office and they can check. But So you need to be on top of your vote. You need to make sure that your vote is counting. You need to make sure that you're finding out where your polling place is, how it's operating. Some of those deadlines for absentee voting or mail-in voting are like today, and that may be too late. But think of the polling workers every time you've gone in person to vote. Who makes up the polling workers? It's people who are dangerously at risk for coronavirus. And so they may need polling workers. They may need you to volunteer and step up to make sure that Election Day runs. So I highly encourage, if you are skeptical about this, if you are skeptical that your vote will count, you're skeptical that the system, you think the system is rigged, you have the ability to go and participate and be a part of the system. The reason that I don't think that the system is rigged is that I've been a part of the system for so long, personally counted votes. I was involved in recounts where my candidate won by 3 and another one where they won by 14 in city council races in the 12th largest city. Like, when you see the system at the maximum tension, you see people's dedication to making sure that your vote counts. But you have to stay on top of that stuff. And, you know,
You're not arguing for personal responsibility, are you?
Oh, I know. It's so weird. But Ben Smith in the New York Times had an article that I think was kind of telling as to where it's heading, in that all of these pundits who are trying to plan for election night keep calling all of these election officials at the counties and states, and nobody is giving them answers. You know, your election division is a check and balance on your county clerk and vice versa. You know, we have 92 county clerks and one state election division with both parties represented, and they're a check and balance on each other. And sometimes the clerk doesn't know what they're talking about, and the state election division helps, and vice versa. But none of those people, none of the 97 organizations that deal with voting in Indiana, are returning the calls of these people, you know, and it's the same everywhere else. Nobody knows what's going on, which means nobody knows what's going on, which means it's going to be worse than we think. And the conspiracy theory levels are already so incredibly high, you know. And so I would just encourage you, John Ulrich, if you don't know how the system works, don't just spout off on Facebook that the system is not working, unless you've called your county clerk. Because you're just making things worse with conspiracy mongering. So, all right. Can we move on to Biden?
Sure.
Okay. So, Joe Biden is 77 years old. He was born in Scranton, Pennsylvania. I'm going to give you some biographical details.
Terrible town.
Scranton, PA. I'm a big Office fan, like the rest of America. Do you guys like The Office?
No.
Yep.
How do you not like The Office, Harry?
Harry doesn't like anything.
I watched a few episodes. I've actually been to Scranton, Pennsylvania. I don't know.
I remember Scranton, Pennsylvania more for a Harry Chapin song back in the 70s. So
Joe Biden, 77 years old. He is in 1953. They moved from Delaware to Wilmington, Delaware. Trump recently said that Biden abandoned Pennsylvania, and Biden was like, I was in third grade. So he graduated from Syracuse University. From the University of Delaware with a double major in history and political science in 65. He was 506 out of 688 in his class. And he went to Syracuse Law School, and he finished 76 out of 85. Now, Biden also had a terrible stutter, which he didn't really get under control and tame until his late 20s. He would spend hours reciting poetry in front of the mirror. And I think that's, Reinhold, why he makes a lot of these gaffes. He still says that I will fall prey to it if I am tired. So there's still probably a little bit of that.
Well, and he's getting older. I mean, it's going to be harder to mentally focus enough to prevent the stuttering or the misspeaking, that sort of thing that goes on. So as you kind of get older and you start declining, as I can attest, it becomes harder sometimes to have the same amount of focus and energy that you did when you were younger. So that's probably, I would imagine that that's probably just going to get worse for the rest of his life.
Now, during his first year at Syracuse, Biden was accused of plagiarizing 5 of 15 pages of a law review article, and he failed a course and had to retake it. Now, this is how far we've come in terms of presidential scandals, because when Joe Biden ran in 87-88, the revelation that he plagiarized in college, you know, 20 years earlier, sunk his presidential campaign. Harry, contrast that with Grabber by the you know.
It's slightly leaps and bounds different.
I'm going to vote for that guy now. He's grabbing by the pee.
Not that plagiarist. Oh, man, I can't believe plagiarized. Just, well, I think the other thing is just because probably a lot of people who voted for Trump, because he grabs him by the pee, probably also plagiarized. You know, allegedly. Yeah. I don't know if they did or not, but it sounds like people who got a Wikipedia did copy and paste.
Or had somebody buy take his SATs for him. At least he didn't do that, right?
There's no proof in that, Reinhold. There's no proof.
There's an accusation.
So that sunk his career. Let me read this from his website.
Such a quaint time.
Biden, who has served in public life for around half a century, is emphasizing his government experience, seeking to cast himself as a steady, seasoned hand in a dangerous and uncertain world. As the coronavirus crisis has unfolded, he has looked for ways to help voters. Picture him as a commander-in-chief, formulating recommendations rooted in advice from healthcare and economic experts. Those suggestions, including making coronavirus tests broadly accessible and free. He has said that there should be no out-of-pocket costs for patients to receive an eventual vaccine either, and he has been sharply critical of Trump's response to the virus, accusing him of acting too slowly. Biden, who served as vice president under Obama during the passage of the Affordable Care Act, and health care remains a top priority for him. It's an issue he often discusses in the context of his family's personal tragedies. He lost his first wife and infant daughter in a car accident in 1972, and in 2015, his son Beau Biden died of brain cancer. Healthcare, he said, isn't in an early television ad, is personal to him. He supports adding a public option to the Affordable Care Act, but opposes Medicare for All, the sweeping single-payer measure advocated by some progressives in his party, including Mr. Sanders. Biden, who served for the Senate in the Senate for decades, firmly believes in the value of bipartisanship and insists on extending overtures to Republicans, even in a moment when many in his own party don't see negotiating partners on the other side. As a former chairman of the Senate Foreign Relations Committee, he also speaks passionately about asserting and defending America's role as a leader on the global stage. Now, I said that was from his campaign website, and I'm sort of right. That was actually his biography on the New York Times.
Hard-hitting journalism.
Yes. Hagiography, as it may be referred to. But that gives you a brief overview of they're going to drag this guy across the finish line. So, you know, his early political career, so after graduating from law school, he started practicing law as a public defender, and then for a firm headed by an active local Democrat. He was a Republican, and then he was disgusted by some local shenanigans and registered as an independent, and eventually ended up switching to the Democratic Party. And it was around this time when he switched. And so at the end of 69, now I should also mention he also led a sit-in in the late 60s when he was in high school. So he was politically active and politically minded even back then. He told his first wife, "I'm going to run for Senate, and then I'm going to run for president." And this is when he was, you know, in his mid-20s. So he's been single-minded for such a long time. So at the end of 69, he ran to represent the 4th District on the Newcastle County Council, a usually Republican district. He served on that county council from 70 to 72. And so he ended up working his tail off to win this county council seat in Newcastle, Delaware, and it's like a heavily, heavily Republican district, and he ended up winning by 60-70% of the vote in that first go-round. So, you know, his hallmark has always been, you know, shaking the babies and slapping hands, or however that goes, kissing hands and shaking the babies, right? and he, just getting out there, the retail politics, the schmoozing with people. You know, he's the son. His father was in the oil industry and then kind of went south. He did not grow up with me he was not a rich guy. He's never been a rich guy. He really didn't make any money until the end of the Obama administration when he published a book. You know, he always lived in a very modest house in Wilmington, Delaware, and which is kind of outside of Philadelphia. When I took a trip to Philadelphia, I accidentally ended up at the Joe Biden Amtrak station because that's the station that he would ride to Washington, D.C. in all of the time. Like, he was... His persona, and I don't think that this was a put on. You guys tell me what you think about your perception of Joe Biden. His persona in Washington, D.C. was, I'm just Joe. I'm just a regular, hardworking guy. I'm not about all these pretenses, and I'm not, you know, even now during the campaign, he's at home, staying at home for the most part. He has two aides, his traveling aide and his chief of staff from his Senate days and Obama days. They come to the house. But most of the time, he's just hanging out at the house alone, having dinner with his wife, and then on the campaign trail virtually. Most of the time, most of these guys would have staff there 24/7. You know, they would have a lot of demands. They wouldn't be doing any. He's just picking up the phone, calling a lot of people. Like, his thing, and I don't think it's shtick. I think it truly is him, is that he wants to be the anti-senator. You know, and that's why he has always connected with blue-collar people, because that's where he came from. I'm a poor guy from Delaware. I grew up that way, and I don't want to change.
And I think that's probably accurate and real. I think a lot of it has to do, too. I mean, I think he had ambitions when he was younger. He's going to be a senator, then be president, right? But I think I don't know if a lot of people really understand, but I think the death of his first wife and his daughter really affected him in a way that kept him from getting a swelled head and keeping himself mm-hmm. grounded. When they talk about him riding the Amtrak into DC, that was because he was staying home and taking care of his family, his kids, because instead of having a house in DC, like a lot of senators do, where they just live there and they party and do all that stuff, he would go home every night and take care of the family. So he never got caught up in all of that, that type of environment in DC either. How much of that is, you know, political posturing, and how much of that is his real life? I mean, I don't think you can get away with it as long as he has, if it wasn't real, you know, so, at least somewhat yeah. grounded in right. reality.
Yeah. So we'll yeah. talk about the Senate. Go ahead, Harry.
I was going to say, yeah, in our earlier characterizations of Joe Biden, even during the Obama administration, was this is the grounded, down-to-earth Joe Biden surrounded by millionaires. You know,
right.
when he was in the Senate, it's like he is surrounded by millionaires. Everyone's in there is a millionaire, probably except him, you know. And it's, you know.
Were you on the show the time that we talked about how they had to figure out a guard shack for his house in Wilmington because it was like just on a regular Philly-type block? You know, it was just like a regular four-story or four-room house, and, you know, there was nowhere to put, like, a place to guard the vice president when he wanted to go to his house, and he finally was able to build, like, a more pastoral scene where he's hanging out now. But, you know, it was really inconvenient because the guy lived a very, like, non-assuming lifestyle.
Well, they said, too, he was always the poorest senator.
Yeah.
Whenever they did the how much net worth everybody had, he was always at the bottom.
But Ron Paul had golds and wasn't a senator, sorry. But the I don't remember if I was on the episode, but it's kind of weird because I can remember hearing it on the show, but I don't know if I was on the show.
Right.
I'm sorry. It's like a weird memory right now. Oh, that's weird.
It's like he's the opposite of Bernie Sanders, who has three houses. You know, like he didn't cash in, and he didn't really try to seek his position to cash in. And so kudos to him on that. We'll give him points on that stuff. But
it's Vermont, okay?
Right, right.
Most people in Vermont and New Hampshire, if you have a bunch of, if you've stayed up there and watched your money, you will have two houses living in Vermont and New Hampshire.
Now, you mentioned a very foundational moment because after his election to the Senate, which we'll talk about in a moment, before his swearing in, there was a car accident where his three kids and his wife were driving and were hit by a truck that was carrying corn cobs. And it was a semi-truck, and it hit the car. It killed his infant daughter. It killed his wife. It was in 1972. Bo and Hunter were both injured. And at the swearing-in ceremony, it, you know, Bo is in a wheelchair with a cast on his leg, and he was a single dad. And so in his first year as a senator, all of his staff said there's no way this guy's going to last because he was just checked out mentally. I mean, he was just really struggling to do the job because he was, you know, mourning and grieving. He was taking care of his two sons. He was trying to keep their lives as normal as possible. He had some family help. And he had a rule that it does not matter if I am interviewing the president of the United States on the Senate floor. If my boys call, you come get me. And they take priority. And I think that's probably why he stayed in Delaware. It is a short commute. It's, you know, an hour or two commute. But to give them some sense of normalcy after they lost their mom. Mm-hmm. So I think that was – so in 1972, he decides to run for Senate. And it was one of those things where there was a very long-time Republican senator in the seat, J. Caleb Boggs, and he had decided – he was waffling on whether or not to run in 72 and hold the seat. And Nixon convinced him in 72 to – we'll give you full party support. Please run. We need to hold the seat. Because in 72, that was in the middle of Watergate, and there was an absolute bloodbath. Or was that 74 when there was the big waves? I thought 72.
So, 72, he won in a landslide. The Watergate came out after the election in 72, and it didn't really hit till 74.
Okay. All right. So 74 was when, like, Lugar ran and lost to Birch Bayh. So I was getting that all confused. So a U.S. rep, Pete DuPont, and Wilmington Mayor Henry Haskell Jr. were going to have a divisive primary fight, and that was going to possibly tip it to the Democrats, and that's why Nixon got involved and asked this guy to Boggs to run again. And so Biden was the only one that stepped up. You know, one of those races in your home state or hometown where it's like you're the fool who's just going to give it a shot. You know you're going to lose. He wanted to run, start building some connections. He grassroots campaigned again. His sister ran the campaign, Valerie Biden Owens, and they focused on withdrawals from Vietnam, the environment, civil rights, mass transit, more equitable taxation, and health care. And he won at 30 years old, which is the cutoff for a senator. He was the sixth youngest senator elected to the Senate at his swearing in, and he won by 3,162 votes. And so he became, you know, he served in the Senate until 2009 when he became the vice president, and he has been on your dole until the last few years. Now, so this is when we're going to jump into the Senate career and start talking about some of the stuff that is, frankly, a lot of it's kind of ugly when you talk about a lot of his Senate record. And when you talk about what is the swamp, what is the thing that he is the guy that we just have railed against forever as libertarians, quite frankly. He in 74 described himself as liberal on civil rights and liberties, senior citizens' concerns and health care, but conservative on other issues, including abortion and the draft. He was Catholic. Probably still is Catholic. He met Jill Biden in 77, and they got married in 78. So a few years after his wife, that's where he met his current wife, to kind of close out his personal life stuff. He became the ranking minority member on the U.S. Senate committee in 81. And in 93, he voted in favor of a section of a broader federally mandated policy that deemed homosexuality incompatible with the military life, thereby banning gay Americans from serving in the military in any capacity. And in 96, he voted in favor of the Defense of Marriage Act. Reinhold, what is the Defense of Marriage Act? Because I've heard it in relation to Bob Barr, who ran for the Libertarian Party nomination in 08, who wrote the thing, but I don't quite remember what the Defense of Marriage Act was.
It was a federal law that basically states that gay marriage wouldn't be accepted in federal jobs, wouldn't be recognized. So in the federal government, that they would not be allowed to recognize any union between same-sex marriage.
Okay. So obviously, you know, I mean, most Democrats were kind of in that wheelhouse at that point. Obama, many people forget that Obama, and when he ran in 08, was not for gay marriage, but for civil unions. Hillary Clinton was the same. Trump
Yeah, DOMA was passed underneath Bill Clinton.
Yeah.
And was a, yep. He's a big proponent for it too. So it was, it wasn't until the Democrats in 2012 trying to, I think, gin up more support, decided to finally embrace the position that the libertarians had had since 72. Right. So,
yeah.
That was something that came out that a lot of people think has always been that way, but it's not. It's fairly recent.
Yeah, the first gay man, openly gay man, to get a, other than President Baldwin, Buchanan, the first electoral votes was John Hospers. The first Libertarian Party candidate for president was openly gay. And the first woman to get an electoral, was he not openly gay? Am I wrong in that?
I don't think he was superly openly gay.
Well,
he wasn't closeted, but he wasn't open about it
either. Who was in 72, for goodness sake? Other than Rip Torn.
He wasn't going to parades or anything.
Was it Rip Torn or Rip Taylor? Those, I always get them confused, and they're very different.
Rip Taylor is the one with the confetti.
In the buckets.
Rip Torn is the one from Men in Black with the you know, unfortunately passing away recently, but just the best lines in some of the best movies. He's so great.
So he really, where his Senate career anchors on chairing the Senate Committee on the Judiciary from 87 to 95 and in the minority, Biden sponsored bills primarily in these areas. 19% of his bills were on government operations and politics. 18% were on crime and law enforcement. 17% were on international affairs. 11% were on armed forces and national security, and 10% on economics and finance. And so that may give us a good idea of where he may look. Again, that was politics, government operations, then crime and law enforcement, international affairs, armed forces and national security, and economics and public finance. He missed 12% of his votes, which is 2% higher than most other senators. Senate Foreign Relations Committee, he was a longtime member. He became the ranking minority member in 97 and chaired the committee in 2001 during till 2003. So obviously a very important time. He actually opposed the Gulf War on grounds that it, well, a lot of people at the time, I mean, you could probably speak to that better. There were actually people who opposed the Gulf War, which I was shocked to like grow up and find out, because I was just, you know, as a kid in 91, and I'm like, who doesn't love a good war? Well, apparently Joe Biden was against the Gulf War.
Bill Hicks has a great bit about that, and I think Dennis Leary stole a little bit of it, but it was just about how we became just like, it was such a powerful war in the fact that we won so overwhelmingly, but the people don't remember when it first started happening, when we first started discussing maybe going to war, we were hearing Iraq was the fourth largest army and this is going to be a horrible thing. And, you know, it was a lot of people were put in fear over that. And there were people who were really scared that we were going to have, it was going to be a long, prolonged, either Afghanistan that Russia had just gone through or Vietnam that we had just gone through. Nobody wanted that. Right. So they were afraid it was going to turn out to be like what ended up being Afghanistan.
Yeah.
So, but I remember when Bush Sr. He was going to give a speech about whether or not what he was going to do about the invasion of Kuwait that night. And he famously, you know, there were cameras looking through the window of the Oval Office, and he got a phone call, showed him crumpling up a piece of paper and then pulling out a pen and started writing. So he got a phone call that changed his mind and made him decide to go and basically kick Saddam out of Kuwait. So a lot of people were very patriotic at that point when things started happening. And it was one of the first really so it wasn't the first televised war, as it were, because there was a lot of footage coming out of Vietnam and those types of events. But when we started having a lot of the high tech stuff and CNN had just started, right? So CNN is needing footage and they're talking about the war 24/7. and the government's giving them all this footage of the bombs going down and the cameras going down and everything, you know, and just the luckiest man in the world, which is the guy going across the bridge. I don't know if you remember this or not.
Yeah.
But he was labeled the most, the luckiest man in the world because he was going across the bridge and he just got to the other side when the bridge blew up.
Mm.
So they had all this great footage and it was like watching a movie.
Yeah.
And people were just like, patriotism and we're going to do this and yay America. And
they had like,
we were bombing them back to the Stone Age. It was so much devastation in that country, what we were doing to them.
We actually, there's a great book that about propaganda where they sent over like a million American flags and handed them all out. And so it looked like the Iraqis or the Kuwaitis and Iraqis were supporting us. And it's some evil shit once you start looking into pro-war propaganda.
I can't remember if Wag the Dog came out because of the war or before the war and was just ironically almost similar.
No, that was after. That was Kosovo. So Wag the Dog was more like about Kosovo years later because I remember being kind of middle school when that came out. So speaking of Kosovo, in 1999, during the Kosovo War, Biden supported the NATO bombing of the Federal Republic of Yugoslavia and co-sponsored with McCain the McCain-Biden-Kosovo resolution, which called on Clinton to use all necessary force, including ground troops. Biden was a strong supporter of the 2001 war in Afghanistan. Whatever it takes, we should do it, he said. As head of the Senate Foreign Relations Committee, Biden said in 2002 that Saddam Hussein was a threat to national security and there was no option to eliminate that threat, but to eliminate it. In October 2002, he voted in favor of the U.S. invasion of Iraq. As chair of the Foreign Relations Committee, Biden had enormous influence and argued strongly in favor of the invasion. Now, just days before the vote, Biden said, "I do not believe this is a rush to war. I believe it is a march to peace and security. I believe that failure to overwhelmingly support this resolution will likely enhance the prospects that war will occur." Biden was able, because of his position, to choose all 18 witnesses in the main Senate hearings on Iraq, and he mainly chose people who supported a pro-war position. The restricted testimony that Biden allowed played a major role in the deception of the American people. And his witnesses argued in favor of regime change as the stated U.S. policy. They warned of a nuclear-armed Saddam sometime this decade. And they said Iraqis would welcome the United States as liberators. So we remember all three of those points, don't we, Harry? Like, you hear that stuff and you go, oh, peace and security, regime change is possible, nuclear-armed Saddam is imminent. They'll welcome us as liberators. I remember being, you know, we were kids and, late teens, college age, going, they're right. They'll welcome us as liberators.
They'll let us put us like McDonald's down there. It'll be great. It'll be like America too, but in the Middle East, it'll be awesome.
Another instance of American propaganda was, do you remember when Saddam's statue was torn down? If you watch the footage, you'll see it's really tightly shot. And if you were to pull back, it's because they had a perimeter set up that allowed nobody but pro-American protesters into that square to tear down that statue.
That's the thing, too, is people think that Bush engineered that going to Iraq thing. And he didn't. I mean, that was something from before him. That was that was Bush Sr. and Clinton.
Yes.
And Clinton and the Democrats for 8 years pushing hard line against Iraq because we didn't invade them. We kicked them out of Kuwait and stopped. Right. So we could have gone in and taken it over and they didn't. And the idea was that we were supporting them to regime change themselves. And then Bush turned his back on when they tried to do that, turned his back on the people there who did, and they ended up getting gassed and killed. But for 8 years, Clinton and all the Democrats were fighting and pushing and trying to get Saddam removed from power and even supporting going to war. When the election came around in 2000, the support for Iraq and removing Saddam from Iraq was around 68% to 70%. Right. So people think that, you know, this was just something that came out because of 9/11. It was something that was in the works and driving to anyway. 9/11 just kind of flipped the switch to say, okay, we're going to do it.
Yeah.
Right. So the Democrats pushed for this for 8 years. Then they complained about it as soon as it happened. And I think I remember. Somebody said we'll give Bush one war,
mm-hmm.
right? Oh, we'll give him one, but when he tries to go to another area, that's when mm-hmm. we're going to stand up and fight him, right? It was all political. It was all calculations, right? So they said, okay, you can go to Afghanistan. That'll be the good war, but we don't want you going anywhere else. And then he said he wanted to go to Iraq, and he mentioned two other. What was it, the Axis of Evil,
mm-hmm.
North Korea and Iraq and
Ohio.
What was it? Oh, Ohio. yeah. So he went to Iraq. He said, we're going to finish that in Iraq. We're going to take care of this issue. And, they said they were going to go say, no, we're not going to let you do it. And it just shows the duplicity that the Democratic Party have and people like, the Blue Dog Democrats and the, mm-hmm. and the, Joe Bidens, that they are not that much different than the neocons were when foreign policy came around.
No, I think people who are younger especially don't realize the whatever propaganda you think goes on around Trump or Antifa or whatever now, it's just not even close. Like there's so much more information now that mm-hmm. it is so much. I mean, and you tell me if you agree or disagree, Harry. Like that period, everybody in the government was so lockstep. And the media was so lockstep with the government in going to war with Iraq that there was no room for any other opinion. And you were canceled aggressively. Look up the Dixie Chicks incident. If you don't know what happened to the Dixie Chicks, you know, the thing about the censor type people
it's
is
the chicks now. It's just the chicks.
It's just the chicks, right? The thing about people that will use censorship is that they allow it by getting hung up on something else. And so, like, the Dixie Chicks went to a concert overseas, I think it was Germany, and denounced the war with Bush and in 2003-ish. Maybe it's 2005. I don't know when. But everybody was pissed. And I said this, too, because I was a good neocon back then. It's not that I disagree with their right to say it. It's that why would you go and say it overseas? You know, it's sort of like, it's not that I disagree with Joe Jorgensen saying that people should be anti-racist. It's that she said the word must. It's not mm-hmm. that I disagree with the removing Confederate statues, but why do it right now? You know, there's always that, like, just sometimes. Say what you want to say instead of like, so I wanted to say the Dixie Chicks shouldn't be anti-American and anti-war, and I'm mad about it, and because that was unpopular to be that direct about it. But that's what I was saying.
Yeah, it's not that you were saying I'm all for people defending themselves and carrying weapons to protest, but you know, don't approach a car if you do that.
Right. Yeah.
You get what you deserve then.
Yeah, we've got libertarians mad about jaywalking. If you jaywalk, you violated someone's nap and you deserve to get killed. It's just bizarre and insane. And
I think back then though, it was easier to tightly control the narrative.
Yes.
Now it becomes a lot harder.
Yeah. Well,
with independent journalism and cell phones and everything else, it's really hard to lie to the American people and get away with it as easily as they did. It takes a lot more work and effort to do now.
Go ahead, Harry. Sorry, nope, we just keep stepping on him.
Right, it's actually, to me, it was that was government cancellation and that was government control when they had a lot of gatekeeping. That was easy then. Now mm-hmm. it's a little bit more difficult, but the biggest difference is that the which we call fake news is more of a, them citing themselves. It's the same way that UFO and all those conspiracy theories will have done for years is that they will cite their sources, which is their own books from like 2 years ago. It's the exact same way a lot of these people are creating a lot of this propaganda now is they all cite each other's articles. So one incident will get cited five different times in a game of telephone and go back to the exact same thing. And with all these different websites, stuff like that, that's where a lot of the quote unquote fake news is coming from like that. And the worst part about it is that you can get things, you can get people that are NewsGuard verified and have all check marks to NewsGuard doing the exact same thing like that. Back then, yeah, it was harder for which at the time was actually more truer independent media sites of people out there going like, hey, I saw this. This is what I saw on the ground reporting, like the stuff we got during Occupy Wall Street, where people just went down to Occupy with a camera and was recording everything and reporting back online of what they're seeing. I think that more organic type of independent journalism is barely here anymore. That has mostly been standard sanitized, and this fake televised revolution is what we're getting now.
Well, that's a big problem with the big tech censorship, is that when you want to go and look 5 years ago, if you wanted to look up information, you could find a Ford Fisher news to share video on YouTube's platform. But if you look up something now, you see, you know, ABC, NBC, CBS, CNN, you know, and those are the very people that lied to us about Iraq. Those are the ones who lied, who bought hook, line, and sinker everything that Joe Biden was pushing back then. Everything that Colin Powell, who, you know, comes out and trashes Donald Trump. It's like, Donald Trump is right about Iraq. Like, he actually nailed that one. Now, you know, for whatever that one's worth. But, you know, Joe Biden lied to the American people about Iraq. He lied to the American people. He's been wrong on, I think it was maybe Rand Paul who said he's been wrong on every major foreign policy point his entire career. What has he been right about? And he's exactly right. He's wrong on foreign policy every single time. When you look at the track record of the things he supported, he was wrong on it. And once we get to crime, I'll move on to the crime stuff now, if you guys are okay with that. Yeah. He was wrong on all this too. So, is that Gunther screaming in the background?
Yes, I'm sorry.
No, that's okay. It's cute. I plan to have many screaming children in the back of my podcast someday, too. So, the criminal legislation, the crime bill stuff, he gets dinged a lot, and we all, oh, well, he authored the crime bill. That's one of those things that we say all the time. I say it all the time. But we have no idea the facts about some of that stuff. This is like one of those things that we say that we heard on a podcast, and I'm sure it's true because I trust that podcast I listen to, but I don't know any of the details. Now, I will say all of these show notes and all of these facts and figures and all that stuff will be in a PDF in the show notes. So if you're like, I heard that on that podcast and I want to look this up and cite that source, we're going to have that for you in the show notes. Make sure you grab that there. Just another service. Thank you to our Patreons. And thank you especially to Sam Schultz, who wrote these great notes and prepared all this and just does an amazing job as our chief researcher and head of our research team. And we sound so much smarter thanks to Sam. At least I do anyways. So in a 93 speech on the Senate floor, Joe Biden boasted, "The truth is, every major crime bill since 1976 that's come out of this Congress, every minor crime bill has had the name of the Democratic senator from the state of Delaware, Joe Biden." Biden has recently apologized for portions of his anti-crime legislation, but he has largely tried to downplay his involvement, saying that he got stuck with shepherding some of this stuff because he was the chairman of the Senate Judiciary Committee. Now, once you look into his record, that's complete hogwash, hokum, bunk, lies, even. His current characterization of his roles in the past are at direct odds with his statements, his actions, his voting record, and you're about to see that. So, as early as 1977, Biden pushed for mandatory minimum sentences that would limit judges' discretion in sentencing. Biden also partnered with former segregationist Strom Thurmond on a string of bills that effectively rewrote the nation's criminal justice laws with an eye toward putting more criminals behind bars. When we talk about the world's largest amount of criminals incarcerated per capita in the world, in the United States prisons, it's Joe Biden's fault. He is directly responsible for that. He takes credit for it, as you just heard him say. Can you explain what a mandatory minimum is, Reinhold?
So mandatory minimum is basically the sentencing guidelines that you have with sentencing people who are found guilty of crimes. And a mandatory minimum is saying that for this crime, no matter what the situation, no matter what the judge considers – in weighing the evidence on when they're sentencing somebody that they have to be incarcerated for a specific amount of time for those crimes. So there's no leeway. There's no understanding from the government on it. It's a hard set, at least this much time in jail for whatever crime that is. And was he also the part of the three strikes legislation as well?
That came about in 90. I think that came about in 96. So yes.
Yeah. So he's part of that too. So the three strikes thing is basically if you get, or if you found guilty for the same crime three times, you're getting like life in prison. You know, you're considered unfixable at that point. Right. So just remove you from society. So even if there are minor crimes, you know, like a possession or the drug war, where we get into things that really shouldn't be crimes or things that that everybody was doing, but they decided to stick on these other people because those people are of a different group that we want to try and silence. You know, that's how that stuff comes about. So that just gives the power of the government. You know, government to the power to the government to say, hey, we're going to be hard on crime, when really what they're doing is they're taking away all the empathy and understanding of why people do certain things or get caught doing certain things, and having that take place as part of the thought process and sentencing of those people.
Yeah.
They're not trying to rehab them at that point. They're trying to house them. They're trying to punish them. Right.
Yeah, as Brian says, three felonies, not three of the same crime. Yeah.
Right.
So in 1989, Biden lamented that Republican President George H.W. Bush was not doing enough to put, quote, violent thugs in prison. In 1993, he warned of, quote, predators on our streets, end quote. And in 94, in a Senate floor speech, he said, quote, every time Richard Nixon, when he was running in 72, would say law and order, the Democratic match or response was law and order with justice. Whatever that meant, I would say lock the SOB up. That's right.
Familiar to, you know, what I remember hearing over the past 4 years about.
Right.
You know,
here's what you have to understand as we go through this section.
Context.
Donald Trump is Joe Biden in 1984. They're the same person. They really are.
To be fair to Joe, the 92 riots just did happen.
Right. Yeah. Right. Okay. He's like,
that's the horror of the 92 LA, the riots of that's the American public just watched these riots happen. Displayed on TV. I was in second grade at the time when these riots happened, and those images still stick in my head of watching that on TV.
But you got to remember, to take away from that, Joe Biden also got elected during the time of the 68 riots and the Vietnam and the Kent State and all the other stuff that was going on. So it's kind of hard for him to say, oh, I was just, you know, we hadn't seen anything like this before.
Malarkey.
Exactly right. He's never seen anything. All right, fair point, Reinhold. Fair point. All right. Wow, Reinhold just shot my help for buying the crap. Thank you, appreciate it.
No, I mean he doesn't deserve it on this one. You know, I think.
Yep. I think about that. Yeah. Yeah. The stuff that happens in the 90s and some of the 80s is easy for me to put in context of what happened around. After that, it's kind of like, you know, even Kent State just seems like, oh, that's history stuff.
Right.
Yeah. It's old times.
Old timey.
I was 7, 8 years old when that happened, 6 year old, something like that.
Old timey.
So, old timey.
All right. So, you know, lock the SOBs up. In 93, Biden said, it doesn't matter whether or not they're victims of society. I don't want to ask what made them do this. They just must be taken off the streets. '93 Biden's a real treat. In 77, while in charge of the subcommittee overseeing prisons and sentencing, Biden pushed to narrow judicial discretion by creating a commission to set presumptive sentences and to eliminate pardons and parole. So you pay for those folks to stay incarcerated longer, less time they're out working, less time they're building skills, less time they're taking care of their family, less time they're it's really crazy.
The only incentive for them to even act in any good way within the jail system is taken away. So now they have no reason to not just be complete, you know, psychopaths in jail. If you're telling them that good behavior and parole and proving that you have rehabilitated isn't taken into account, why do anything at that
point? Right. His aim, he told the Wilmington Evening Journal, was equitable and definitive sentences for all, including defendants who, quote, don't meet the middle class criteria of susceptibility to rehabilitation. There's no other way, Harry, to read that other than white middle class people are the standard for society, and if you don't meet those standards, you're not welcome here.
Western civilization tells us, right? I'm just waiting for the part where he says, and we should deport them back to where they came from.
Right.
And it would be just like it could have been written last year for a Trump speech.
Come on, man.
Wow.
The 90s was lit.
1984 crime bill. In 84, he was the Democratic floor manager for the successful passage of the Comprehensive Crime Control Act, the controversial Tough on Crime Bill. The CCCA of 84 was the first comprehensive revision of the U.S. criminal code since the early 1900s and was signed into law by Ronald Reagan. So, FU states, FU local governments, the federal government under Ronald Reagan, the great liberator, the great libertarian hope, is going to assume control of all of your judicial. So they reformed the federal code. This act established mandatory minimum sentences for drug offenses. Among it, its other constituent parts and provisions were the Armed Career Criminal Act, Sentencing Reform Act, which created the United States Sentencing Commission, extension of the Secret Service's jurisdiction over credit card fraud and computer fraud, increased penalties for cultivation, possession, or transfer of marijuana, a new section in the criminal code for hostage taking, and stipulations about using civil forfeiture to seize assets of organized crime. We've talked a lot about civil asset forfeiture.
That's the one.
Oh my God. Yep.
That's where it started. It didn't start with terrorism. It started with organized crime back in the 80s.
And Joe Biden. Biden also served as a ranking minority member of the Judiciary Committee. I can't say that word. On the passage of the 1986 Anti-Drug Abuse Act, this act created much harsher sentences for possession of crack than for powder cocaine. How many times have you heard Black Lives Matter activists talk about this stuff? This is like the go-to that people talk about when they're talking about, you know, the revolving door of prisons.
Institutional racism,
systemic racism. Joe Biden was the head of the committee that passed this act. The act mandated a minimum sentence of 5 years without parole for possession of 5 grams of crack cocaine, while it mandated the same possession for 500 grams of powder cocaine. That is a 100-to-1 disparity and was reduced to 18-to-1 when crack was increased to 28 grams by the Fair Sentencing Act of 2010. So it disproportionately affected the black community. By a 2002 report to Congress from the U.S. Sentencing Commission found that in 92, 91.4% of federal crack cocaine offenders were black. Mm. Now, in the 1994 crime bill, which you've heard a lot about, Biden chaired the Senate Judiciary Committee again during the passage of the Violent Crime Control and Law Enforcement Act. Biden helped author and was a major proponent of the vast catch-all tough-on-crime bill. In Senate floor speeches in 1993 and 94, Biden spoke openly of wanting to rid Democrats of their reputation as being soft on crime. He said, "One of the things I want to do, in addition to end crime, is to end the political carnage that goes when we talk about crime. This is one of those issues that I hope, after this bill, will be moved out of the gridlock category and into an emerging consensus." The bill he helped fashion was a vast catch-all bill that has a string of punitive measures desired by law enforcement. The bill was basically written by law enforcement in the wake of things like the LA riots. It banned assault weapons, created 60 new death penalty offenses, stripped federal inmates of the right to attain educational Pell Grants, gave states incentives to build prisons, set aside money for 100,000 new police officers, and codified the three strikes rule. The law imposed tougher prison sentences at the federal level and encouraged states to do the same. It also backed grant programs that encouraged police officers to carry out more drug-related arrests and escalation of the war on drugs. Now, in a speech on the Senate floor, Biden said the telephones in the state of Delaware are ringing off the hook. They're not talking about pork or pork chops or anything else. He's always been this way. They're saying, pass the crime bill, give me 100,000 cops, build more prisons, and get on with it. Very Dickinsonian, this guy. On the website for his 2008 presidential campaign, Biden referred to the 94 crime bill law as the Biden crime law and bragged that it encouraged states to effectively increase their prison sentences by paying them to build more prisons. Ooh, that's rough.
Oof, that is, oh man, it's just terrible. Just like everything that you've known to be just bad.
It is everything that A, libertarians are against, and B, everything that Black Lives Matter is against. And, like, not for nothing, Donald Trump and his efforts for criminal justice reform and his conversations with people like Kim and Kanye West has been way more open to criminal justice reform than any other modern president. Like, this will be, we'll cover this next week when we talk about Trump, because this is one of the positive things about Donald Trump. And I think when he says, I've done more for black people than anyone ever before, that is kind of what he's talking about. But, you know, it's been minor at best. But when you compare in terms of the goals of ending what is systemic racism, Joe Biden ain't the dude. He is the guy who created this stuff. And then he's going to pick Kamala Harris as his VP potentially this week, who is the same on all this stuff and has just as bad of a record. The guy is never going to give any of the people who want criminal justice reform. Joe Biden may be forced into it because of a mea culpa, but I can't see that happening. I think he'll pivot to something like healthcare to fix Obamacare and undo the mistakes. And, you know, if he picks Susan Rice, that's a clear identifier that he is moving towards foreign policy, and he'll go on an apology tour like Obama did, from the likes we've never seen, to try and fix foreign relations. I can't imagine that happening just because domestic will be so consuming with the virus. But, you know, it'll be interesting to see who he picks as his VP. Like, are you going to continue this record? Are you going to try and reform things? Probably not. Or are you just going to pay it lip service and do nothing? Yes.
It's like, all right. Is Biden the man?
Yes, Biden is the man. When we're fighting the man, he's the man, Harry. Is that what you mean?
Yeah, it's like he's the man. It's just like everyone keeps like, well, the crack and everything. I think Biden's the man.
He's like, the man you were fighting.
Yeah, you can lay a lot of the problems with the black community at his feet and just go like, you did this.
Yeah.
This is your fault.
So let's talk about his record on drugs. It doesn't get any better. It's all downhill. Like, we said the nice things about Biden at the beginning. Like, the reconciliation portion of our show has ended. We are going full libertarian screeching against this guy here now. Biden, in 1982, he's the one who coined the term drug czar. He's the one that created the czar term that was so famous or infamous during Obama. In 1982, in a New York Times article, Biden coined the term drug czar when he called for the federal government to create the new role. But Senator Joseph R. Biden Jr., man, I forgot what the R stands for, but it's some like really like weird, funny middle name. Harry, can you look up what his middle name is? Because it made me laugh. It made me giggle. But I've been up since 5 a.m. and it's 9 p.m. and I'm goofy.
What, the Orange Theory?
Nah, I didn't make it today. I've just been working, working, working. So Biden, who is a strong advocate of anti-narcotics efforts, said today that he thought no program could work without a cabinet-level drug czar in charge to coordinate the work of various agencies. In 89, Biden went on national television to criticize a plan from H.W. Bush to escalate the war on drugs because his plan didn't go far enough in escalating the war on drugs. Quite frankly, the president's plan is not tough enough, bold enough, or imaginative enough to meet the crisis at hand, Biden said. He called not for harsher punishments for drug dealers, but to hold every drug user accountable. Robinette, Joseph Robinette Biden Jr. It's a family name. Bush's plan, he added, doesn't include enough police officers to catch violent thugs, he said, not enough prosecutors to convict them, not enough judges to sentence them, and not enough prison cells to put them away for a long time. There's that thug word again that he keeps using. Biden co-sponsored the Anti-Drug Abuse Act of 1988, which strengthened the prison sentences for drug possession, enhanced penalties for transporting drugs, and established the Office of National Drug Control Policy, which coordinates and leads federal anti-drug efforts. Charged with formulating and administrating America's drug prohibition game plan, the ONDCP almost immediately began agitating for a massive expansion of interdiction enforcement and incarceration efforts. So he got his new office and immediately started growing and empowering that office to put more people of color in jail and warehouse more poor people without any hope of getting out of the cycle. Charged with formulating and administrating America's... Oh, I read that. Quote, no attempt should be made to disguise the fact that significant new resources will be required to pay for many proposals advanced in this report. Last February, this administration requested nearly $717 million in new drug budget authority for the fiscal year 1990. Now, after 6 months of careful study, we have identified an immediate need for $1.4 billion more. With this report, the administration is requesting in 1990 the drug budget authority totaling $7.8 billion. In 96, when the Office of National Drug Control Policy came up for reauthorization, Biden voted in the Senate for the bill and added this direction for the department. The director shall ensure that no federal funds appropriated to the office shall be expended for any study or contract relating to the legalization for medical use or other use of a substance listed in the Schedule 1 of the Controlled Substances Act. He means marijuana. And take such actions as necessary to oppose any attempt to legalize the use of such a substance in any form. There's different schedules of drugs. And Schedule 1 is the most hardcore. That's PCP and angel dust and cocaine and heroin and pot. Pot was put in there. Joe Biden helped.
He's the man.
He's the man. The office committed itself to keep certain substances illegal, even if new credible information came to light. In fact, as the last line suggests, the drug czar is even encouraged to take whatever action is necessary to keep this information from the American public. So when we talk about how the boomers screwed up America, this is what I'm talking about. All of Joe Biden's career, bad on foreign policy, bad on spending, bad on the war on drugs, bad on crime, bad on the centralization of government. These people don't know what they're talking about, and this person isn't qualified to be the president of the United States because he's a certified idiot. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. A 2006 report by the ACLU found that in 1986, before the enactment of federal mandatory minimum sentencing for crack cocaine offense, the average federal drug sentence for blacks was 11% higher than whites. 4 years later, the average federal drug sentencing for blacks was 49% higher. So in 86, before the mandatory minimums, the average sentence was 11% higher. After the mandatory minimums, 49% higher. That is directly due to Joe Biden. In 2003, Biden sponsored the Reducing Americans' Vulnerability to Ecstasy Act, the RAVE Act, which altered existing legislation known as the Crack House Law. And basically, it made it legal for prosecutors to treat a nightclub like a crack house. And so they would go after the property and the businesses of any club owner or promoter if drugs were found on their property, which means civil asset forfeiture, and they could seize anything they found in there. The law basically turned clubs into crack houses. In the last few years in the Senate, Biden did not support the full elimination of the sentencing disparity between the crack and powder cocaine. That we're talking 2000s. Biden remains one of the very few prominent Democrats who still failed to endorse cannabis legalization at the federal level. And according to his recent stance on the subject, he decriminalized use, moved to expunge records for using, remove federal enforcement in states that have legalized it, and remove it from being a Schedule I narcotic. I can't imagine that's where his heart truly is, considering. So, you know, Reinhold, I've watched enough, like, Alpha House or West Wing or, you know, 90, like Dave. What did I just watch the other day that was a political comedy about the 90s? You know, or My Fellow Americans, rest in peace to Wilford Brimley. That's his greatest role, was in My Fellow Americans. You know, I've watched enough of that to know the cynical thing in the 90s was, you know, grab onto an issue that's popular and ride that, look like you're tough on it, you're the man on it. You know, and that's how he was with crime. Like, this is a popular, high-polling issue. I'm going to be the guy on it. I'm going to be the guy being tough on crime, and that's going to help me get elected to the presidency in 88 or 2008. Mm-hmm. I mean, is that how this feels? Like, you give us any insight into why this guy was so wrong on crime and drugs?
Well, I think it's part of it is a conservative background that he has. He's not a liberal, right? By any stretch of imagination, he's a Democrat. We started with the conversation where he was originally a Republican and he switched to Democrat because he probably felt he could get on the ballot easier that way.
He's a Catholic too.
Yeah. He's a conservative. He's the older generation, the boomers. They're very conservative people. They grew up in the 50s times when things were great. And why isn't everybody wanting to go back to the 50s without realizing there's a whole segment of the population that did not have the greatest time in the 50s as they did. So he's taking a long time to get through there. And I also think some of it's very cynical. So we talked about how his persona of him being just a working class guy and all that was sincere, came from a place of sincerity. I think a lot of the times the decisions he stands for or pushes for are what gives him the most camera time,
political capital.
You know? Right. So he's a lot more cynical. So he's able at this point to try to go, okay, now I changed my mind on all that stuff. And that's what he's going to be trying to do. But you saw with the civil asset forfeiture where it started out as just the mob guys. And then he wrote, you know, and he wrote that stuff. And then he wrote the civil asset forfeiture for let's do it for drug offenses. Right. I mean, that was the progression up into the 2001 where it became, oh, let's get the terrorists too. So that, you know, that's where that all comes from. But I think I still think a lot of it is more just rooted in his conservatism as a conservative Democrat than it is trying to see where the winds of the people go as much.
What is he conserving? The idea that to be a reformed criminal, you must meet middle-class white standards?
Yeah, for the most part. I mean, that's, if you think about what conservatism is, it's conserving the old ways, the old institutions, the law and order, right? So in order to fight law and order, you have to be tough on crime. People don't understand that, they don't like the new age hippie. We have to understand where they come from and why are people violent and why are people breaking the law. And they don't want to understand that. They just want to punish it. Because if they figure if they punish it hard enough, if they dominate, if they smack down, people will finally say, okay, I'll not do that. You know, it'll finally be enough of a deterrent to them to not do that. But we've seen with the death penalty doesn't work as a deterrent. It never really has. So how can you be harder than that on anybody? So I don't know how you can keep that mindset personally of these are about deterrence as opposed to trying to fix what's broken in this person and make them more of a capable human being in society. But that was the mindset of the 50s, of the 60s, of, you know, law and order. You know, you just did what was right. You punished the people who did wrong. And
he's the perfect example of like culture is downstream from politics because people wanted this because the population begged for it. Joe Biden gave it to them. And if they hadn't wanted that certain thing, he would have given them something different.
Exactly. And that's the thing, too, is that America at the time was very conservative in that thinking, in that thought process of how to deal with criminals.
Yeah. You know?
It's the punishment of smacking the kid on the butt or trying to figure out why they're acting out.
Right. No, I think that's a good point. You know, it's domination versus empathy. Brian says Biden has always had presidential aspirations and going back to the 80s and running a tough on crime Democrat would make him more palatable to the population as a whole during the Reagan-Bush time frame, except it's always all BS. Biden has always tried to ride the middle line of politics of middle America. You know, the only people that helped in his 72 Senate campaign were the AFL-CIO, and he always had a close relationship with the unions and always tried to go after that lane, which is why when we're talking, we're looking at the 2020 field of Democrats, we go, this guy's the one that appeals to the broadest range of Americans because he has strategically positioned himself like a chameleon to be that way. I do think there is some, you know, here's a guy who wants to ride the train. Like, I'm not heartless. I'm sure there is part of that is real, but I'm not also naive in thinking that there wasn't strategy to some of that stuff too, and trying to position yourself for a certain, you know, as a media brand, we try to position ourselves for, you know, a certain strain. Like we're positioning ourselves for new libertarians, right? We're positioning ourselves. We try not to be inflammatory too much towards the left or right or new Democrats. Well, yeah, you know, Dennis or Reinhold, but what can you do? You know, everybody who is in public life, of which we are in public life, politicians are in public life. If you're talking to large groups of people, you do think about your image. You do think about how you are positioned. You do think about how people perceive what you do, knowing you can't totally control it, but you can to a certain extent. You know, it's hard to fool people. You know, it's hard to. I have worked around politicians, race car drivers, comedians, celebrities. My entire 20-year career, people that are in public life. I've never seen anybody in private. There's been one person out of all the people. If you look at a celebrity or you look at a public figure and you think they're a jerk, they're a jerk. I can tell you for a fact, Danica is a jerk or was a jerk when I was around her. She may be totally different and grown up now, but she was not nice back in the mid 2000s. But everybody kind of knew that. You could tell that, right? There's only one person I've ever seen fool everybody who was that had an image of gold, a nice person, total ass bag behind the scenes. It was a race car driver and a fairly successful race car driver of Brazilian descent. That's all I will say. But you will have to do the rest of the work. But, you know, every politician that you thought was a jerk that I met behind the scenes, total jerk. Gabriel Iglesias, Jeff Foxworthy, Larry the Cable Guy, Jim Gaffigan, nicest people I've ever met. I've never met anybody nicer than Fluffy, you know? And like, you can tell that if you watch them. So I think there's some aspect to it where you go, yeah, Biden is probably playing up his strengths and decreasing his weaknesses, but he probably is kind of that blue-collar regular guy. But the issues that he chose to emphasize, I definitely think, are telling of his character. And his character is, I want to be president. I will tell you whatever you want to hear to make that happen. You know, so here we are.
And part of the problem is going to be that the Democratic Party is has and always, you know, kind of always has, but is still currently fighting for control of the party. Who's going to lead the party? And it's, is it going to be the moderate Democrats, the Blue Dog Democrats, who are more conservative, or is it going to be the leftier wing type of Bernie Bros?
Right.
And you talk about that. So you've got Black Lives Matter, who obviously is not going to be a big fan of Joe Biden. But then you look at the Bernie Bros and who authored the bill who made student loan debt non-dischargeable through bankruptcy. That was Joe Biden.
Mm.
So what's the big, one of the biggest things that the Bernie Bros are trying to get pushed through is that's forgiveness of all the student loan debt. Well, the reason that there is student loan debt like that, one of the biggest reasons is because that bill was authored.
Right.
And now, you know, you have all these schools knowing that not only are they getting backed by the government, but they also know that they can't be discharged by, you know, they don't have to worry about it being discharged by bankruptcy. So they know that that debt's good forever, that they can bank on it.
Right. Right.
So
you're telling me Joe Biden is why my college tuition is so expensive?
Yes, it is.
Yes.
This guy, man, what a... Okay.
Man.
Yeah. White people get student loans. Black people get prison time. It's equal.
Yeah. Basically, white America from the boomer perspective.
Well, think about it, too. You talked about the sentencing drug lines being changed between crack and regular powder cocaine in 2010. But it was only changed so it's not as disparate as it was.
Mm.
It's still pretty disparate.
Right.
You know. So it went from what, 18? You know, from 10 to 18. And then we still have like a 300 or something like that.
Because the communities have been cannibalized by this for 30 years. Like, it, you know, it doesn't take a genius to figure that out.
You know, people don't understand where the crack thing even comes from. It wasn't because, you know, black people preferred crack. It was just, it was, you know, it was easier to sell at the time to those people. Right. So, I mean, you know, the gangs were trying to infiltrate and make the money, because that's what happens in a prohibition. You have the gangs starting running the illegal drug trades, right? Just like we did in 1920s. I mean, it's people can't look back at history and see the repeat of everything that they've done. They continue to just keep doing it, and we're doing it with this. We've still got, like I said, all the stuff that you were hearing Biden say in the 70s and 80s. Trump is saying the same thing to get himself elected.
Yeah.
You know, and he's doing the same thing. So it's,
he's
not
just
like
appealing to the people that Joe Biden tried to. Yeah. Biden is trying to appeal to a different base. Trump is trying to appeal to the base that Joe Biden tried to appeal to in 30 years ago. But that's what we know about Donald Trump. Donald Trump descended the Golden Tree House in 1983 and has never stretched his worldview beyond 1983. And he still thinks like your dad's golfing buddy. And, you know, that's just his reality. He doesn't want to deal with the other. He just wants to deal with what he thinks is like his version of American exceptionalism is, you know, the wealthiest, the most stuff, you know, the whitest, prettiest face, maybe of European, Eastern European descent. He'll negotiate on that. But, you know, I mean, and the most guns, the biggest military. Like, that's his version of American exceptionalism, not the traditional view of American exceptionalism, which is natural rights tradition, you know, a federal system with localities having the most power, unity through diversity. I mean, you know, Joe Biden isn't that far off from that same notion when you really look at his record.
Right. And you can remember, where I live at right now is very... it's the people he's speaking to is where I go to the local market this weekend.
Mm-hmm.
And it's a small town, you know, 1,000 people live there maybe at the most. And, there's a guy in there without a mask on going, I can't believe, you know, people are making us wear these things. And, you know, it's just, you hear this all the time when you kind of spend a lot of time in rural America, is that there's a mindset. And it is strong and it is there and it's not going away anytime soon, but it's also rooted in really no experience dealing with a lot of different types of people. It's kind of growing up with the same mindset all around you and that just prolonging and living longer. Like Well, I was growing up in the 70s, but I was living in the country. So, or like in the 80s. So I had all the 70s stuff in the 80s. Right.
Right.
When we were dressing like we did in the 70s. But my wife, she lived in the city at the time. And there's pictures of her. She's 4 years younger than me. And there's pictures of her with the big hair and all the stuff. And we were still, you know, the girls were still wearing the 70s haircuts and stuff back then. So it was like 10 years behind the rest of the metropolis areas or the more urbane areas, because there's just more variety there for society to kind of grow and evolve. Living out in rural America, you don't get that. So you stay in that, you know, the Waltons type of mindset of what America is supposed to be. And right. I think that's the kind of thing that people like Trump and Biden have both kind of played to the whole careers, because they were the ones who made sure they went and voted, and they were the majority for a long period of time. I think it's switching. I mean, it's changing up. I think with the internet, that ability to isolate goes away a little bit. Mm-hmm. And I think we're going to see a lessening of that, but that's kind of how the duopoly of America has happened, where we have, you know, people in the cities who are more exposed to things like that being a lot more liberal, as it were, and then the rural being a lot more conservative. That's going to start to fade away, I think, as we go forward with more integration in the internet.
Yeah, for
sure. I like to think that. I don't know if it's going to actually happen or not. But
no, I think the internet's weird because it increases diversity but also encourages homogenization. And so you lose the regional dialect, you lose the regional news, you lose the we are focused solely on the presidential race because we don't have access to reliable information about local races. You know, you'd be more interested in the local races, I guarantee it, if you had a way to pay attention to it. But the media encourages, the incentive structure for We Are Libertarians is to broadcast to the nation, nay the world, as opposed to Indianapolis. You know, that's why we choose to do it that way. You know, if you want to grow something big with a national focus, you know, that's more attractive for ego and monetization reasons and just interest, because it's easier to get information, right? I can go look at think tanks all day long, but there's no real think tanks about Indiana politics, right? Like, so if you're intellectually curious, it's just kind of, you know.
Well, there's Boss Hogg.
There is Boss Hogg, thank goodness, and Boss Hogg, Mother Hogg, writes in, the Waltons were progressive, though, so she's right.
Well, the Republicans were progressives back in the turn of the century.
Yeah.
You know, all the ones who wanted to keep out all the immigrants, they were all progressives.
Yep. We would be remiss if we didn't address the sniffing. So I think it is important to give some context to, you'll see your libertarian conservative friends or Republicans even, you know, posting, oh, he's a sexual predator. All right, well, let's take a look at what that means exactly and give you some of the facts on that so you can decide for yourself. Biden has been accused of inappropriate contact with women at public events such as embracing, kissing, gripping, and touching. Is that wrong? In March of 2019, former Nevada Assemblyman Harry's shaking his head. Just kidding. In March of 2019, former Nevada Assemblywoman Lucy Flores alleged that Biden had touched her without her consent at a 2014 campaign rally for lieutenant governor in Las Vegas. Flores recounted her experience with Biden in an essay for New York Magazine, describing an incident in 2014 when Biden came up behind her, leaned in, smelled her hair, and kissed her on the back of the head. Amy Lapos spoke out to say that at a fundraiser in 2009, Biden touched her face, leaned in for what she thought was an attempt to kiss her on the mouth, and then rubbed her nose with his. Biden has also been criticized for being too handsy with children. At a swearing-in ceremony for Chris Coons, Biden held the upper arm of the senator's preteen daughter, whispered into her ear, and kissed the side of her forehead. Coons has said that Biden's words and actions did not bother his daughter, who has known Biden her whole life. On March 31st, 2019, Biden released a statement saying, "In my years on the campaign trail and in public life, I had offered countless handshakes, hugs, expressions of affection, support, and comfort, and not once, never, did I believe I acted inappropriately. It is suggested I did so. I will listen respectfully, but it was never my intention." Days later, He released a video on Twitter saying that he will be more, quote, mindful about respecting personal space in the future. Now, earlier this year, Tara Reid, a former aide to Biden, accused then-senator of sexually assaulting her 27 years ago. Biden has denied the allegation. He essentially cornered her in a parking garage and put his hands in places he shouldn't have. And she says that she reported it to his office, and they say that didn't happen. There's no record of it. And, you know, her mom called into Larry King. There's a ton of contemporary witnesses. Frankly, there's more evidence of her story than Blasey Ford or anything against Roy Moore, which is why so many people on the right were so outraged that this didn't get any coverage, and it took weeks of shaming the New York Times and other publications to take this seriously. And it wasn't until the Me Too movement finally started to go, we can't be this hypocritical, guys, that it started to get some traction. Rightly so. Good for them. Now those records that would confirm or deny, because we need evidence of this. Her word, because she's talking about Joe Biden, isn't good enough, unlike Blasey Ford's. Not diminishing Blasey Ford, but, I mean, it really pisses me off when there's no consistency on this stuff. A principle matters more when it's not politically expedient. I mean, if you, like, on the Me Too stuff and on racial issues, you've probably noticed what some would consider a drift leftward, but it's really more of a drift towards decency and empathy. And when it comes to how women are treated in this country, it's absolutely abysmal. And if you actually take the time, sit and talk to your female friends and the women in your life on a deep level and actually listen, this stuff's very common. And the Me Too movement in a lot of ways has been very, very healthy for this country in talking about that sort of thing. They do that movement a disservice when they don't take this stuff seriously. And that pisses me off. And I think it should, you know, it should make you mad because it matters that women are being mistreated, and every political group does it, including the Libertarian Party, and it needs to stop. And we have to hold our own accountable first and foremost. You know, this show was talking about how, you know, in 2018, 2016, I think it was 2016, having to have basically bodyguards walk around with, you know, one of our friends at the Libertarian Party convention. You know, so another thing we've been talking about years before the party started to take it seriously. Those who know what I'm talking about know what I'm talking about. You know, so now that Senate record is being held by the University of Delaware. In 2011, Joe Biden donated 1,800 boxes of documents and 415 gigabytes of electronic records from his time as senator to his alma mater. It includes committee reports, drafts of legislation, and correspondence. And under an agreement made with the university, the records were set to become public last year. However, the records are being kept secret. Following new terms, the university posted on its website just before Biden made his presidential campaign official. Starting in 2011 and for years after, the university had described the terms of the agreement as keeping the paper sealed for 2 years after Biden retires from public office. Magically, as he ran for president, they adjusted the language and the requirements. On the day before Biden announced his campaign, the university changed the way it described those terms. Instead of citing his departure from public office, it said, "After he 2 years after he retires from public life," whichever is later. It does not define what public life actually is. A spokeswoman for the University of Delaware says the entire collection is unavailable, as he is currently running for office and he is in public life. Since retirement for anyone, not just public figures, takes different forms, I can't speculate beyond that. Now, in July, the Daily Caller News Foundation and Judicial Watch announced they're suing the university, and they filed a lawsuit in the Superior Court of Delaware on a FOIA, a Freedom of Information request, both groups made back in April, hoping to get the records. They said the university should do the right thing and turn over Biden's public records as required by law. Partisan gamesmanship by a public university is unseemly and unlawful. If they don't want to do the right thing, we will force them in court. Biden's Senate records became the subject of scrutiny after Tara Reid came forward and suggested that her formal complaint documented harassment in Biden's office might be stored at the university. So there you go. That is some of the details on that stuff. I don't know if you have any, either of you have any comment on it, or if you'd like to move on to final thoughts.
Harry?
Yeah, I've got nothing. His record of that is, there's tons of compilation videos. You can just watch it, and, you know, it's pretty well known that, yes, Biden was protected from most of these videos, and there's nothing really to say with it.
Final thoughts, Harry, go ahead.
A couple of things. The stark realization getting ready for the show is that Biden's the man. He killed disco, the rave scene, gave us grunge music. He ushered into grunge. We could have had an amazing music of disco and this house music going in the 90s, but he ruined that. He gave us grunge music. It's all his fault.
Well, what do you expect from the man?
He's the man. But this show, and especially Sam's notes and his well-cited sources, this document is the perfect thing to, I'm not saying to use it as like, it's that more of a, it's a conversation starter. Sitting around having a social distance beer or wine or soda pop. With someone, and you know, you want to bring up the election, and like, well, you know, it's like, well, how can you do this? Well, how can you do this too? Can we talk about that?
Miss Pat, for instance, why you're going to let Trump win? And I'm like, I want Biden to win. Why? You know, and this gives you facts. Like, here's this guy is responsible for these things that you have personally. You know, it's like,
right.
When people on the left want to shame you for voting for the Libertarian or not at all, or for the Green, or, you know, Democratic Socialist of America, for goodness sakes, like this guy is not worthy of being president.
Correct. It's not worthy. And it'd be different if his whole campaign was talking about, yes, I made a mistake. Everything I've ever signed into law was a mistake. And I want to go for president. It's like, everything was a mistake. Yes, I was bad. That was awful bad. I want to get these people out. I want to help these people and fix the people I've destroyed. But that's not his campaign.
Right.
You know, his campaign is not an apology tour to try to, I need the power of the presidency and the House and Senate to fix the errors of my youth.
Right.
That's not what it is. It's, you know, it's just, it's a continuation.
His campaign is just a ghosting.
Yeah, that too.
I don't blame him.
I don't either.
This Ben Shapiro has said this, and he's totally right. In 2016, the polls were determined by who was the topic of the news. Was it Clinton or Trump? If Trump is in the news every day, he's going to lose. If Biden is the topic of conversation, he will lose. You know, I think it's probably more structurally biased at this point towards him, but like, you know, if it does get too lopsided where people get too comfy, like 2016, to Harry's point, and people go, we don't need to worry about it, no need to go vote, Hillary Clinton's got this sewed up, you know, there's a chance. And so, you know, the Democrats get too comfortable, and they go, this guy's not the guy, I'm not voting for him. You never know what could happen, because Right. They're, like, as a libertarian, there is... personally, Joe Biden doesn't seem like a bad man. Like, Hillary Clinton seemed to be the epitome of evil to me. But, like, Joe Biden doesn't seem to be a dislikable bad man, like, in a one-on-one situation, right? Mm-hmm. But big government progressivism with militarism, all of this record, like, there is nothing to me in his record where I look at as I've studied for the show, where I can go, this guy makes me want to vote for him. Like Hillary Clinton was the same way. Like, you're interventionist in every area and around the world, and like, there's not much that we can, maybe like, okay, cool, you'll declassify Schedule 1 marijuana, that's Schedule 1, like, cool, you got that one. But like, as an overarching philosophy, the modern Democratic Party, as evidenced by Joe Biden and Hillary Clinton, offers the libertarian almost nothing to support.
Yeah, and those were, and just moving marijuana out of Schedule 1, that's a pittance.
It's just like a drop in a bucket.
Right, that's nothing for the damage it has done being where it's at.
And yet we still can't get that.
Right. Can we get that? Can we get that? You know, it's okay. I was listening to one of the newscasters. It was like, October surprise. If Trump's really thinks there's going to, he's going down. He's going to go, you know what? Decrim, full legalization of marijuana. It's the October surprise, which, if that's the October surprise from Trump, I'm going to fall on the ground laughing. But it's, how can I just want to just, it's just have those conversations. Trust me. Like I've had these with my own family members and watching them just sit there in that realization. And then they started like really questioning the 4 years of Obama, 8 years of Obama. Like what really happened? I'm like, yep. What really did happen back then? Take the nostalgia and the rose colored glasses and really, examine what happened those 8 years of Obama. I will say, like, the other thing with the censorship, you remember when the look back at the old video of the Ferguson riots, not only did we was able to watch that in real time and watch the real abuses of the police state to citizens in Ferguson, because the social media wasn't really censoring them. I'm talking about you could get on every night, get on the whatever streaming platform and watch people just stream this video. Now it's censored, easily better cut. It is, and they're only showing what you want to see. That's like whenever it's a lot of the stuff in Portland. Trust me, there's more video out there of what was going on. The other thing I wanted to ring about with the voting thing is that the mail-in votes, a lot of mail-in votes, are being tossed out and thrown out because their signatures don't match, which is utter bull crap, but they're getting tossed out, or they don't fill it in correctly, or they don't arrive on time, or, or other weird mailing things just because, it's a government run agency and they're running and they're sending mail. So good luck. And with the voting booth, yes, if you have time off and you believe that voting is a good thing, you may want to try to help them because they're not going to be staffed. That means the lines are going to get long and some people are not going to have all day to vote. So if you actually care about the process, you believe that the harder you vote is going to do something, go ahead.
In Georgia, for instance, in the primary, why there was such a problem is that in the northern sections, there was one machine. The Secretary of State put one machine for every 50 people. In the south, they put one machine for every 5,000 people. Guess which part of the state is white and which part of the state is black. So that's why there are lines. And so it's the only way at this point for Donald Trump, according to the polling, to win is to suppress the vote. But he still is doing it the stupidest way possible, because by attacking mail-in voting, he's attacking his base. He's suppressing his base because they vote mail-in and absentee more often than anything. And so he's because he doesn't know anything about the system or how any of this works, it's continual self-owns. Like, if I were a Trump supporter, I would just be mad all the time because this guy is completely messing up everything that he says he believes in. Like, he does the opposite once he actually puts things into place. Reinhold, final thoughts?
Final thoughts is... I don't know. I mean, I said at the beginning of the year, I was trying to point out to you before, I think even, you heard from other people that Biden was most likely going to win the nomination. And then when he didn't do good in that first, Super Tuesday, or not Super Tuesday, but the initial Iowa one, a lot of people were saying, counting him out. And I said, no, it's not going to happen, because I understand what the mindset of America is right now, I think, a little bit. And that's, they're just exhausted and tired with this experiment. It isn't working. It's worse than what we had to a lot of people. Yeah. That's what they think, right? That's a perception. It may not be real. I mean, we can look at all the things that Biden was architect for, but there's just a sense of or a feeling of returning to a normalcy that even if it's bad, it's better than what we have now, where it's just pure incompetence and graft and just,
gaslighting. When you have an opportunity to leave gaslighting and run away from gaslighting, people more often than not will take the opportunity to remove the gaslighting from their life and seek relief. Like,
right.
You watch these interviews, he's clearly, you know, I don't know what's going on. Like, it's like 25th Amendment time. I mean, if you watch some of this stuff right now, the last month he's deteriorated. He looks terrible too. Like, he looks super overweight and like losing his hair
for a while. But yeah, he's I think he's getting worse. I mean, you know that as a president gets in his 4 years, he ages quickly. You look at some of the pictures of presidents past and how it just takes a toll on you.
That's the terrible option with these two.
Yeah. That's the other thing, is that neither one of them may make it to the end of to the next term.
Right.
To the next election. The 2024, we may be, you know, having a funeral in office for all we know. We don't know. I don't want to wish that on anybody at all, but that's just the reality of it.
Truth is the truth. Like, even if it's ugly, you have to say it out loud at some point.
Right. And so, but I think that's really the mindset of a lot of people. I mean, you had a lot of things scared a lot of liberals and leftists when, we had two people now put on the Supreme Court, and we've got the a lot of states trying to push all of these draconian abortion laws, and the left is just looking at that going, oh my God, we cannot let Trump have another swing at putting another person on the Supreme Court. It's going to just set America back. That's their mindset. So they're going to fight against that. They're fighting against that. They're not fighting for Biden, right? As I said, I think a warm chair would have won, you know, would be leading in the polls right now. And that's what they gave us, was a warm chair.
Right.
Really what's going to happen, and I think a lot of people who are more astute about this needs to really focus on who is picked as the vice president. Because if Biden wins, which it looks like he probably will, most likely the vice president is going to be given a lot more power and groomed to take over after the first term. So you're almost voting for that person for president as you are than you have been in any other election. So a lot of elections, they talk about the vice presidential candidate. They talk about the debates. And they say, this is the person who could be one step away from the president. Look what happened with Kennedy. And then we had, you know, Johnson. So we need to make sure that person is who you want in there. And, you know, I don't think it's been more true than it has been this election, who that vice presidential candidate is going to be on both sides. Because if Trump gets reelected, he's going to go full bore. You thought he was bad now. He's not going to be worrying about getting reelected. He's going to do whatever he wants. And whatever he's wanted to do before has been horrible for the Justice Department. Right. For just the rule of law in this country and doing whatever he wants to do, knowing he can get away with it. You don't think he's going to get reimpeached again if he gets reelected and the Democrats take over the Senate in the meantime? What do you think is going to happen? First thing, boom, we're going to relitigate all of the stuff that we got before. So there's a possibility that it passes that time with a Democrat controlled Senate. You know, at least some of that information gets out there. And then now you've got Pence is going to be, you know, president. So in either case, it really the vice presidential candidacy in this election is more important than it ever has been.
Yeah. Totally agree. I thank you both. We are way over time. We try to keep these at 2 hours now. We used to do 3-4 hour podcasts, but we're not young men anymore. Okay.
Too Dale. Much of a good thing, too.
Dale, just inappropriate. Look at this. Look at this. All right. And
he got like 1,000 likes and 1,000 new friend requests in one day, didn't he?
I think so. And
this is so popular.
Mother Hog. I'm sure Joyce does not like being called Mother Hog, but it makes me laugh. Boss Hog's mom says, I'm with her. Joe 20. I think it's joe2020.com. There is a libertarian choice in this election. You can check out Joe Jorgensen if you'd like to know more. That is who I expect to be voting for, and someone's at my door, so I need to go. All right, thank you so much for joining me, and we will see you next week.